This is a debut broadcast of Unwelcome Guests, a program about wealth, power, and the New World Order. You're tuned to 89.7 and 90.3 FM WEOS in Geneva. I'm Lynn Gary. We're told we live in a free country, but how free are we? We're told we live in a democracy because we have elections. Does our government work for us? The economy is booming, or so we hear. Why then are so many people hanging on for dear life? What is meant by the economy, anyway? Who defines what is referred to as the national interest, and how? If we're exporting democracy to the world, why do we have so many enemies? 2 million Americans are now in prison. Why? You might have heard the statistic that it would be cheaper to send everyone now in prison to college than to keep them behind bars. But college grads won't work for 20 cents an hour, and prisoners must. We're told that if we just work hard, America is a land of opportunity. Why then are one-third of the people in homeless shelters employed full-time? Are we the victims of the largest pyramid scheme in history? Over the coming weeks and months, we plan to bring you discussion on these questions from some of the smartest and best-informed people around. Oh yeah, one other question. Why don't you hear these sorts of questions more often?
I'm Chris Sturr. In celebration of International Women's Day, March 8th, and Women's History Month, on today's program, you will hear several women speaking on the issue of women's labor. In our first hour, we will hear from Marilyn Waring, goat farmer and former member of the New Zealand Parliament, who will speak about how standard economic measures don't take account of unpaid work done largely by women the world over. Later, Elaine Bernard, executive director of the Harvard Trade Union Program, we'll speak about sweatshops, labor organizing, and solidarity. One day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone. But that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by unwelcome travelers.
I'm Jessie Lind. What is International Women's Day? In 1908, socialist women in the United States convinced their party to designate the last Sunday in February as a day for demonstrations in support of women's suffrage. 2 years later, at the second conference of socialist women in Copenhagen, the holiday was adapted to become an international socialist day of demands for universal suffrage. From 1911 to 1915, International Women's Day was celebrated on March 8th with women's parades and demonstrations in many European cities. It was a counterpart of the workers' celebration on May Day. By a coincidence, in 1914, the Russian Revolution began on March 8th with bread riots led by women.
International Women's Day was celebrated occasionally by socialist women in parts of the United States from 1916 to the end of the 1930s. The holiday fell into obscurity in the U.S. until the late 1960s, when feminists in the second wave of the women's movement revived International Women's Day worldwide for celebrations and public demonstrations. At its revival, International Women's Day became associated with various aspects of the history of working-class women. Louise Michel, the French anarchist who lived from 1830 to 1905, has been used as the symbol of the celebration. So have women's strikes in the 19th and early 20th centuries, particularly those in the textile industry in the United States. Accordingly, International Women's Day marchers have often adopted the strikers' anthem, Bread and Roses.
As we go marching, marching, we battle too for men, for they are women's children, and we mother them again. Our life shall not be sweated from birth until life closes. Hearts starve as well as bodies. Give us bread, but give us roses. As we go marching, marching, unnumbered women dead go crying through our singing their ancient call for bread. Small arts and love and beauty, their drudging spirit new. Yes, it is bread we fight for, but we fight for roses too. As we go marching, marching.
From Canada comes a documentary with the title Who's Counting? Marilyn Waring on Sex, Lies, and Global Economics. Marilyn Waring, whose life the film documents, is an author, professor, goat farmer, and former member of the New Zealand Parliament. TUC Radio brings you a one-hour edited version of Who's Counting, directed by Terry Nash and produced by the National Film Board of Canada. At the beginning of the film, Marilyn Waring has just arrived in Canada.
For those of you suffering from economics anxiety, there may be some relief on the way. Dr. Marilyn Waring is speaking in Montreal this evening.
She's a feminist economist, and she's the author of If Women Counted, published in some countries as Counting for Nothing. Her work has been hailed as having global, even historic, significance.
The more that you smoke cigarettes, or the more that you have automobile accidents, the more growth increases. Now, I'd be fairly unlikely, having smashed my car, to come home and say, darling, don't worry about it, we've just contributed to the national income of the country. I mean, I wouldn't run my household like that, and I can't think like that. I would consider that a loss, you know. I would kind of consider that a debit in my account. A cost, not a benefit. National income accounting doesn't have a debit side. As long as the activity passes through the market, it's good for growth. Let me give you a very easy example. The voyage of the Exxon Valdez. Now, the Exxon Valdez is most likely the most productive oil tanker voyage ever known on the face of the planet. Now, if it had simply loaded up its oil in Alaska and made its way down the west coast and discharged into a bunker, it would have been a moderately productive voyage in economic terms. But if you want to have fantastic growth, it's a very good idea to ram your tanker into an iceberg. Immediately, there are the insurance costs and the new tanker. This is great for growth. Then there are the civil legal proceedings and the criminal legal proceedings. Immediately, of course, there's the payment for the cleanup operation. Then down the way a little bit, there are the compensations to fisher people and the compensations to the tourist industry. And of course, there is the film, the television rights, the book, the various newspaper and media exercises that go on. A fantastically productive oil tanker voyage. It all added to growth. Nobody stood there and said, Deary me, just lost an oil tanker. Better subtract that from the national income accounts.
I think most economists place an affirmative value on being incomprehensible. There's some exceptions to that. John Kenneth Galbraith, for instance, writes comprehensibly. But Marilyn, because her goal is to be understood. She understands very well that if people don't have the information, they can't act on it.
In Canada, we've signed a free trade agreement with the United States and Mexico. We hear that it's a whole question of productivity. This is going to be good for economies. This is going to boost our GNP. We look across to Europe, and the same thing is happening in Europe. The Maastricht Treaty is signed, and all these countries are saying, well, yeah, this will be great. We'll be coming together. This will be good for our economies. How does someone like you react to that?
Well, it might change GDP figures, but you're starting from the wrong premise. I mean, all of these decisions were based on the wrong figures in the first place. For 10, 20 years, we've had these clichés, we've heard this rhetoric, you know, inside or outside discussions on free trade. You tell us things are getting better. It's perfectly obvious to us. Our air is getting worse. Our education systems are failing the poorest people. There is more poverty. There is more homelessness. There are more housing crises. And I suspect that the unease that is in Canada and in the United States, and let me tell you, in Mexico, about NAFTA, has to do with the fact that it doesn't matter what they say, GDP might grow up. But GDP is utterly unrelated to the well-being of a community. It tells you nothing about levels of poverty. It tells you nothing about the distribution of poverty. It tells you nothing about primary health care, educational standards, environmental cleanliness. And folks have realized that this unidimensional economic fabrication just doesn't bear any relationship to their lives. It was 1975, was International Women's Year. I was 22 years old, and I put my name in, and sort of 6 weeks later, with some horror, recognised that I'd just been chosen the candidate for a safe seat that I couldn't lose.
Honourable members of the House of Representatives, you meet here today as members of the 38th Parliament.
Notice of motion ready?
Are you?
Yes. No.
My constituency was almost everything you can see. Basically, the farmers around here really work with the earth, with the forces of nature. So you can see lots of shelter belts retained, lots of planting of trees, not too much scarring of the landscape. It included most of the hills and the mountains in the Waikato Basin, so I was quite particular about what was going on in the higher areas.
Every woman in New Zealand knows about Marina Waring and offers up a small thanks to her for making it that much easier for them. I think that's Marilyn's plaque, if you like. It may not be set in metal, but it's written on many women's hearts, I know that.
There's a phrase in Māori, Turanga Waiwai, a place to stand. And my constituency was my place to stand. I mean, I came from here. You couldn't shove me out of here, and you couldn't tell me what the people here wanted. You know, I was one of them. And so I had a real legitimacy, because this was my Turanga Waiwai.
Marilyn Waring's no-nonsense approach to parliamentary politics earned her respect early. In just her second term, she was appointed chairperson of the prestigious Public Expenditure Committee, a position from which she aired criticism of the effectiveness of controls on government spending, the accountability of politicians, and the dead hand of bureaucracy.
In a small country like New Zealand, this is the sole Budget Appropriations Public Accounts Committee of a parliament. So we review everything in terms of the whole 45 government ministries and departments and trading divisions. And I can still recall, you know, interchanges when they were briefing me in my office, and they would teach me something, and I would say, but that's preposterous, or that's crazy, or that's ludicrous. And they would say to me, oh, well, yes, it is, but those are the rules. And I couldn't believe that these enormous paradoxes or pathologies that I was discovering were part of an international economic system. I thought, you know, maybe it's just we make bad policy in New Zealand. Other countries started to invite me there as their guest. And when you went there, you could ask to see their chair people of public accounts committees, their treasury boards, their budget appropriations committees. And I began to realise, hey, it's nothing to do with New Zealand. These are the rules everywhere. And I developed very early a kind of, it was a personal technique, which was in any community that I went into, I'd asked until I was introduced to a woman my age. Well, Tendai was a 14-year-old who lived in the Lurveld in Zimbabwe. And I'm interested in the work days of young women because the International Labour Organization specifies that under 14-year-olds don't work. We're speaking of 16 to 18-hour days every day of the week. And all of the activities that they're involved in this time are unrecorded. They're called non-productive, they're called uneconomic. These women are apparently at leisure during these enormously work-filled days.
Let me tell you about my day. In the morning, before I can wash, I must walk 5 miles to fetch water. When I get back from the well, I wash things for the children, then I cook them some food for school and for the rest of the day. Then I go to gather firewood, which I use for cooking. When I come back, I tend the sheep and goats. Around 6 o'clock, the cattle arrive, then I milk the cows. I spent my evenings worrying about how to get water for the next day. And that's how I spent my day, every day, until sunset.
And the translator asks, and what do the men do? A man in the crowd answers.
A man's day is quite hard. First he must supervise the women and children because they all come under his authority. Then he has to decide who will herd the cattle for the day, and then he worries about how to get food for the family.
It's perfectly obvious that the people who are visible to you as contributors to the economy are the people who will be visible when you make policy. And if you're not visible as a producer in a nation's economy, then you're going to be invisible in the distribution of benefits. And wherever I was, this was the world situation for women. And at the so-called end of their working life, because they don't stop working till they die, but at that point, the government then says, well, not only have you been invisible, but now you are welfare. Now you are a dependent on the state. Now you're one of our obligations. You know, so you've got this extraordinary choice. You go from being nobody to being a problem, in spite of the fact that of all the people in the population, you just worked harder than anybody else for all those years, except you probably didn't get paid for it. It's becoming part of a global situation for me now. I mean, I'm able to make analogies between the unpaid rural women in Bangladesh or in the Philippines and the woman back in my constituency whose work is also invisible.
Please bring up my brother.
Yes.
Kathy, a young, middle-class housewife, spends her days preparing food, setting the table, serving meals, clearing food and dishes from the table, washing dishes, ironing, keeping an eye on or playing with the children, dressing her children, disciplining children, taking the children to daycare or to school, disposing of garbage, dusting, gathering clothes for the washing, doing the laundry, going to the gas station and the supermarket, repairing household items, making beds, paying bills, sewing or mending or knitting, talking with door-to-door salespeople, cutting the grass, weeding, answering the telephone, vacuuming, sweeping and washing the floors, shoveling snow, cleaning the bathroom and kitchen and putting her children to bed. Kathy has to face the fact that she fills her time in a totally unproductive manner.
She, too, is economically inactive, and economists record her as unoccupied. Ben is a highly trained member of the US military. His regular duty is to descend to an underground facility where he waits with a colleague. When I wrote this, it was a colleague, but now, due to drug abuse in the US military, it's with two colleagues, for hours at a time, for an order to fire a nuclear missile. So skilled and effective is Ben that if his colleague were to attempt to subvert an order to fire, Ben would, if all else failed, be expected to kill him to ensure a successful missile launch.
Well, we're trained so highly in our recurring training that we take every month in simulators like this, so that if we actually had to do it, it would be an almost automatic thing. There wouldn't be time for any reflection until after we turn the keys.
Ben is in paid work. He is economically active. His work has value and contributes, as part of the nuclear machine, to the nation's growth, wealth, and productivity.
Since the mid-70s, New Zealanders had begun to demonstrate against the visit of nuclear-powered or nuclear weapons-bearing ships to New Zealand. Well, the nuclear ships issue wasn't just a matter of not having nuclear weapons in New Zealand. It was a whole question of sovereignty. Here on the wharf in Wellington, by treaty, New Zealand was prohibited to store, possess, transport, use nuclear weapons. This seemed to me to be treated with utmost contempt by a so-called ally, the United States, who would draw ships up alongside our wharves, you know, that were nuclear-powered or that would have nuclear arms on them. And so if we were to do anything, the least and the only thing we could do was to ban them from New Zealand, from our territorial waters, from beside our walls. New Zealanders felt this very keenly. They didn't just feel it keenly as a peace issue. They felt it very strongly as an environmental issue.
There should be no nuclear weapons inside our sovereign territory.
Those were the words of an MP who wouldn't back down, and that was the conviction that led to the Prime Minister admitting he couldn't count on her vote on the nuclear issue.
Close to midnight and in high spirits, the Prime Minister with the announcement that shocks the nation. A snap election.
Six and bring them in fast.
There's a sense of urgency about Parliament by now.
I just withdrew from the government on the nuclear legislation, and it forced an urgent election.
Sir Robert blamed Waipar MP Marilyn Waring for not guaranteeing her support for his late-night ride to Government House and the dissolution of Parliament.
Quite frankly, I didn't agree with it. But there you are. It happened, and, you've got to respect Marilyn for her dedication and her beliefs. And as I say, that democracy working. That's a prime example, isn't it, that, one person like that can bring the government down.
She had the majority of people saying, well, good on you, Marilyn, for saying the things you are saying, and that she had a reputation for being fearless and speaking her mind, which I think was... ordinary people appreciated that very much indeed.
The election was fought on nuclear-free New Zealand, and it was a resounding victory. 72% of New Zealanders voted for it.
Did you have any doubts when you walked across that floor? You knew that the government that was in power, the government that you were a member of, could fall.
Sure. It always amazed me that that's not what members of Parliament realise they're there for. I mean, there ought to have been 86 other people sitting there thinking that. That's our job, it seemed to me. I mean, if you're elected to go represent the people, you ought to be ready at any minute, at any hour, at any day, to go on principle. It's not a job for life.
constituency was in good hands. Catherine O'Regan had taken over my old parliamentary seat. So I had some time for intensive research, and I set off to try to unscramble the codes of global economics.
I didn't really have much idea what I expected to find. It was just that this is where the search kept leading me. Everyone kept saying,
well, there are a set of rules, and they're called the United Nations System of National Accounts. And if you want to read the full set, this is where you've got to come.
So it was either going to be the end of the search or the beginning of a whole new one. The United Nations Statistical Commission has annual conferences. It is certainly dominated by ideologues from the United States and works very, very closely with the World Bank and the IMF. And the difficulty is, of course, that hardly anybody from various governments' treasuries, those people who actually define macroeconomic policy, come anywhere near these conferences, have any idea what the new rules are, let alone have ever read them. When massive international rules are operating in a situation where no one who is implementing them is required to read them, then you know immediately you have a massive set of propaganda operative. But it was also so offensive, so chronically malevolent.
And every day or two, I'd find yet another truly horrendous paragraph that meant I had to keep going. The worst day of all was when I discovered the paragraph, subsistence production and the consumption of their own produce by non-primary producers is of little or no importance.
Well, after, I guess, about 2 months of reading through the System of National Accounts, you can start to believe you're slightly crazed or that you're not reading things properly, because the distortions between what is in the rules and what is real life that you observe is so extreme that I kept thinking I'm still missing something. And so again, I went to talk to John Kenneth Galbraith and said to me, look, for goodness sake, write it. Stop talking about this. You've known enough. You've read enough. Just write it.
Well, I'm very proud of that. I have quite a few visits, so not all are strong in my memory, but I certainly remember her coming to see me. We had a long talk, I guess more than one, about the role of women in the economic system. The whole tendency in economics is to take the monetary economy, the pecuniary economy, not only as the basic thing to be measured. If there isn't money involved, if there isn't a price, you don't measure it. And that leaves women's work in the household and a great deal of child care, so forth, out of the national accounts. It is enormously productive work, both for human enjoyment and for the welfare of the economy and the growth of the economy, that doesn't get counted. And it was this that Marilyn was concerned with, as indeed I would like to think I have been.
The system was developed by John Maynard Keynes and Richard Stone, based on a pamphlet they wrote called, literally, The British National Income and How to Pay for the War.
and this became the basis of national income accounting.
Stone was then recruited by the new United Nations organisation to take the rules that he'd had in Britain and to enlarge upon them for international consumption. Of course, he didn't really. He just translated what was a system that suited the British Empire into a neo-colonial exercise for the whole world. And so by 1953, that set of rules was imposed on every country, including all the newly emergent independent countries.
It's called the United Nations System of National Accounts, and to a significant extent, it governs all our lives. All nations must conform to these rules of economic measurement, or they cannot belong to the United Nations. They cannot borrow from the World Bank or secure any loans from the International Monetary Fund. Important decisions are made with these figures, decisions which will determine whose needs are met first, decisions on how to spend your tax dollar, decisions on killing the planet, decisions on who will live or die. These measurements are highly selective. So what is included and excluded in this system? The system includes everything that goes through the marketplace. Everything which has a cash-generating capacity. In other words, the system recognizes no value other than money. Regardless of how that money is made. This means that there is no value to peace. This means that there is no value to the preservation of natural resources for future generations. This means there is no value to unpaid work, including the unpaid work of reproducing human life itself, including the unpaid work of women who feed and nurture their own families. This system cannot respond to values it refuses to recognize. This system leaves out the work of half the population of the planet, and the planet itself. It is the cause of massive poverty, illness, and death of millions of women and children, and it is encouraging environmental disaster. This is an economic system that can eventually kill us all.
The film now takes us to the Middle East, where the Dubai Air Show is in session.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this, the second Dubai International Aerospace Show.
I think everybody has been staggered by the enormous success of the event this year, with comfortably over 400 companies exhibiting from all over the world, widespread of aircraft of every class. The Dubai show is now incontestably
running in third place behind Paris and Farnborough. Of this in any combat aircraft is that it frees the pilot's entire attention.
Looking out of the window and at what he's supposed to be doing, which is attacking the enemy.
The international trade in arms is the biggest growth industry of all.
Scout aircraft are acquiring targets at day or night. It's worked in Desert Storm with...
The five permanent members of the Security Council are also the five leading arms exporters in the world.
Out beyond 10 kilometers, mass-mounted sight.
Killing people, or preparing to kill them, is considered very valuable in the international economic system. Arms exports account for more than half the trade surplus of the developed economies. But the death, homelessness, injury, poverty and starvation caused by the use of these weapons is not even registered as a deficit.
If a country develops an economic system that is based on how to pay for the war, and if the amounts of fixed capital investment that are apparent are tied up in armaments, and if that country is a major exporter of arms and its industrial fabric is dependent on them, then it would be in that country's interests to ensure that it always had a market. It is not an exaggeration to say that it is clearly in the interests of the world's leading arms exporters to make sure that there is always a war going on somewhere.
Every minute, 30 children die from want of food and inexpensive vaccines. And every minute, the world's military budget absorbs $1.3 million of the public treasury. This is war. The United States now devotes over $200 billion a year to military defense against foreign enemies. But 45% of Americans are afraid to go out alone at night within 1 mile of their homes. This is war. For every 100,000 people in the world, there are 556 soldiers, but only 85 doctors. This is war. For every soldier, the average world military expenditure is $22,000. For every school-aged child, the average public education expenditure is $380. This is war. The cost of a single new nuclear submarine equals the annual education budget of 23 developing countries with 160 million school-aged children. This is war. War is marketable. War pays, literally. War contributes to growth and development. The Philippines can be seen as a microcosm of the entire developing world. These are the hills overlooking the port city of Cebu in the southern part of the Philippines. It's a rural area which has been left vacant by an absentee landowner. A group of families have moved onto this land and built their huts and established a community here. Most of the men only get sporadic jobs, or they provide cheap labour for some of the large cash crop plantations around the country. So it's really up to the women themselves to provide for the children. The average Filipino woman has 8 children to raise and no access to abortion, family planning, or divorce. You can imagine the anxiety that a mother of 8 must feel if she doesn't know where she's going to get enough food to feed them all every day. This is the reason that women in rural areas all over the world grow food crops or raise farm animals. This sort of farming is usually called subsistence agriculture. It doesn't involve the exchange of money, but it does ensure that these children will eat.
the system of national accounts says that the domestic and personal services which don't count are the cleaning, decoration and maintenance of the dwelling occupied by the household, the cleaning, servicing and repair of household goods, the care of the sick, infirm or old people, the transportation of members of the household or their goods, the preparation and serving of meals, the care, training and instruction of children. The World Bank would argue that to change the conditions of life for these people requires export growth. To make room for productive exporting enterprises, these unproductive women and their families would simply be kicked off the land. The new company could then take further advantage of the homelessness it had helped to create by getting cheap labour here. The number of homeless children in the urban squalor of developing countries is now epidemic in its proportions. The cycle of poverty begins to repeat itself very early, as the eldest girl in a family at age 8 or 9 is expected to give up school and look after her youngest siblings, while her mother uses that time to do whatever she can to keep her family alive. Older boys may be left to fend for themselves and to sleep in the streets. Jennifer and Renren are 10-year-olds. They're just two of the children available through this Japanese brochure, which sells men-only tourist junkets to the Philippines. Recent studies in Thailand, which also has a lucrative business in female sexual slavery, have shown that 70% of the women and girls have become infected with the HIV virus. Those who sexually exploit children are counted as doing productive work for increasing economic growth. Even if their activities are illegal, they're considered valuable enough to be in the calculations because they're income generating. Female sexual slavery is a major growth industry worldwide. And where a multi-million dollar industry in prostitution is operating, full advantage is taken of this grinding poverty. Foreign-owned companies and a small Filipino elite own 90% of the land. In a country of 58 million people, 20 million are now homeless. Thanks to multinational monocrop plantations, the Philippines is the 14th largest exporter of food in the world. And yet 80% of the children who live here can't get enough to eat. Over 1 billion people on the planet are malnourished. In the developing countries, 50,000 people a day die from malnutrition. Seventeen million children in the world die each year from diseases that are related to poverty. Two-thirds of these deaths are preventable. The gross domestic product claims to measure the well-being of a country. When my friends Imelda and Loris harvest New Zealand seafood for their families, it isn't seen as economically valuable. But if they went and bought the oysters in tins at the supermarket, then that would be counted.
Before the Europeans come on, the Maoris never ever had electricity and things like that. So their food mainly depended on from the sea, was gathered from the sea. We have a custom that's called Kai Moana. Its meaning is gathering of food, mainly shellfish, from the sea. We go out when it's the tide's low and pick up seafood, mussels, oysters. The oysters take about 2 to 3 years to grow. So that's why you just take a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah, we only usually take enough food for a meal, you know.
Then if you're still hungry in a couple of days, you come back and get another bucket full. And then you have them fresh all the time.
But we never sell it. The old Maoris don't sell shell food. It's not meant to be. It's meant, you know, they...
Give it away, you never ever sell it. You get the odd one who'll take it back to the cities to sell, but the elders usually come down hard on them and say, it's costing you nothing, and if you come and take a whole lot of food from here, then the next person that comes along to get some can't find it because you're taking it all away and selling it for money. You should leave it for food.
Well, if I'm going down to a beach to collect kai moana, I always behave the way that I've been taught by the local people, by the Māori people. And I find in this and in so many of the practices in Aotearoa in New Zealand that they make perfect sense. I mean, both perfect economic sense, perfect environmental sense, perfect ecological sense from, you know, centuries of tradition of indigenous people. So why change it? Why behave any other way? I certainly feel in this entire journey that my constituents and then women and the ecosystem has been my teachers. Very early when I was a Member of Parliament, there was an application made for a prospecting licence on Mount Porongia by a company called Gold Mines New Zealand. And the planning procedure was such that the mining company could show all the apparent good that was going to accrue to all of this area. We'll provide loads of jobs, we'll provide loads of support to the service infrastructures, you know, your schools will stay open, you'll get more roading, your post offices, all of those kinds of services, your electricians and plumbers and everybody else will have loads of jobs while we're involved in all of this. There'll be export earnings, it's gold we're talking about. There'll be substantial reductions in overseas funds, you know, we'll be here for years. The usual growth development kinds of arguments. No debit side, you notice. There's never any debit side in terms of this kind of development. Nobody talking about what you're going to do with all the materials that you take out of the mountain that then begin to leach into surrounding farmland. The kind of scarring that would be happening in the bush and the forest and the mountains, the ruin of the habitat of so many species. Colin Murray was a party official in my constituency and a key member of the local farmers' organisation working against the gold mine licence.
It's a fascinating mountain because it's different every day. A little bit of cloud behind it. It was a volcano originally. It also plays a big part in our lives because it affects the weather so much. We have 90-inch rainfall here, which makes this area so good for dairying and farming generally. And that's brought about to a very, very large extent by Mount Porongia. The water around here, I have a lovely stream through the farm across the road there, and the water, the tests that the Waikato Regional Authority have done on the water, it's amongst the purest water in the country, and that's just something you can't put a value on.
Economics is a tool of people in power. I mean, economics didn't just come up from nowhere. It's a tool of those who want to exploit. It's a justification. And so as a so-called science, it doesn't allow for the introduction of values that don't find their way into a mathematical formula. It also operates in terms of language. You know, if you want to argue that mining this mountain would be devastating, you are invited to use a whole lot of words that are called soft, you know, flaky, value-laden, subjective. Economics has got it down really tight, you know, so that if you're not talking their language, if you're not talking in their jargon, you're not part of the argument, you know. So the power of economics mirrors to a great extent, you know, the political power rampant anywhere else. You operate with language as well as operating with mathematics. The economic activity that the mountain is engaged in is like 24 hours a day, never ending. It's the habitat for the pollinating species, without which none of this agriculture could survive. It's controlling the microclimate for the production that comes from everything out here. It's breathing, I mean, it's creating oxygen. And it provides hundreds of hours for just what is euphemistically called leisure and recreation, tramping. None of those features can find a very easy expression in terms of cost-benefit analysis. I mean, you can't run around and say, oh, well, so much oxygen is being produced from these trees on a 24-hour basis, and the same volume of oxygen in containers in a hospital would equal, and therefore the 24-hour oxygen production of this mountain equals. I mean, who's going to do that? This entire story so early in my political years demonstrated to me the absolute hollowness of the mathematical formula that we have to work with. I met with Federated Farmers, the environmentalists, the rural local authorities, the city councillors, and we sat and discussed this mountain and what it meant to us. And we were invited to somehow or other number crunch all of those values into an economic equation and to set ourselves up against Gold Mines New Zealand Limited.
There was a tremendous uproar from the locals and plenty of meetings, well attended, and with Marilyn Waring's help, we managed to block the miners, so that that's not going to take place now. It's a forest reserve now. It's all that bush-clad mountain is reserved as a forest park. This here, this farming that you can see all around you, is here forever. It's not going to go away, and we're producing something far more valuable than gold. We're producing food and clothing for people, wool and so on. And, you know, mankind can do without gold, but you can't last long without food. You know, that was our argument, and I think it's the argument. This goes on forever if we look after it. It's ours for a short time while we're here on Earth, but someone else has then got to take over. And providing we look after it, it should get better and better.
It was just a local story, you know, in my constituency. But I think as an analogy, it can be expanded to the whole planet. But what are we after then? What are the alternatives? Your country, Canada, or mine, New Zealand, where there are political will, could establish qualitative environmental indicators. Indicators that told us
what was happening to water quality, air quality, the remaining stands of forest, the exploitation of mineral resources, the reproduction of fish species, the habitats of endangered species. There is no reason why tomorrow Canada or New Zealand could not establish time use surveys. Because the one common denominator that all of us have, the one thing we might be said to choose to exchange, that is our own, is time. And time is a better description of the needs for intervention in people's lives than any other indicator. It shows you where the crisis points are. It shows you where the service needs are as a policymaker. In a study conducted by the Commission on the Status of Women in Canada, it was demonstrated that 2/3 of all primary health care took place in the home. If 2/3 of the budget for primary health care were directed towards those responsible for that care, imagine what would happen to that budget and how that budget would be redistributed and how the priorities would be turned on their head. These are the kinds of effects in a budgetary sense that would flow from time use surveys. Why don't policymakers or politicians or bureaucrats like this idea? Well, first of all, it's terrifying. They would have to exercise judgment. They don't have a unidimensional set of figures to which they can look and say, is growth up or down? Thereby hangs our decision. Language is a tool available to all of us. None of you, when you leave this room, should ever again say, my mother doesn't work, my wife doesn't work. That particularly relates to people who are in media or teaching positions. Take your census form. It says, what is your primary occupation? Well, be inventive. Pick up the business pages of Saturday's paper. Be a logistics analyst. Be a management supervisor. Be anything that fits, you know, the kinds of things that you do. Just don't be a housewife. Don't be a home engineer. Don't be anything that uses the word house or home in it. You know, how many hours a week do you work? 96, 107, whatever it is. How many weeks a year do you work? 52. For whom do you work? Well, that's an exciting one. What's the name of your company? I found that women can be extremely inventive here. It's good fun, mucking up the census. We've got that rolling in quite a few countries. Push for parity. Join political parties and go to their annual conferences and year after year after year, drive them crazy. Half the candidates shall be women. Half the candidates shall be women. Join this party till you get it through, then move on to the next one. I mean... Just as there is no one-way feminism, there is no one political tactic available here. There is no one political strategy. It is broad and as wide as our imaginations can take it once we have heard and seen and recognised that the emperor has no clothes. You must choose, judge, assess the strategy and tactic in your environment, in those communities that I don't have access to. Just as I do it in communities you won't have access to. I mean, the only principles are that we don't stop, that we are rigorous, that we recognise that it's hard work, and lastly and not least, that we have a lot of fun along the way.
You heard the second half of a one-hour radio version of the film Who's Counting? About the New Zealand author and former MP Marilyn Waring. The film was directed by the award-winning independent Canadian film director Terry Nash. In 1983, she won an Oscar for her documentary If You Love This Planet with Helen Caldicott. That film helped mobilize the anti-nuclear movement of the 1980s. Who's Counting promises to do the same for the alternative economics movement. If you are interested in a copy of the film, call the U.S. distributor Bullfrog Films in Olean, Pennsylvania at 610-779-8226. That's 610-779-8226. For a copy of the full hour program, send $10 to TUC Radio, Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141. That's TUC Radio, Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141, USA. For a credit card order, call toll-free at 1-877-TUC-TAPE. That's 877-TUC-TAPE. My name is Mariah Gallardon. Thank you for listening.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small by giving you no time instead of it all. Till the pain is so big, you
WEOS, Geneva, 89.7 and 90.3 FM. You're listening to Unwelcome Guests. Coming up in our second hour, we'll continue with more on issues of women and labor, including a talk by Elaine Bernard, speaking on sweatshops and solidarity.
On March 26, 1911, over 140 women lost their lives in a fire at a garment factory in New York City. The Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire has become a symbol of the horrors of sweatshop labor. Here is how a contemporary account described the fire.
New York fire kills 148. Girl victims leap to death from factory. From the Chicago Sunday Tribune, March 26th. 1911. 148 persons, 9/10 of them girls and young women, are known to have been killed in a fire which burned out the 10-story factory building at the northwest corner of Washington Place and Green Street, just off Washington Square, this afternoon. 141 of them were instantly killed, either by leaps from the windows and down elevator shafts, or by being smothered. 7 died in hospitals. Falling bodies hurt rescuers. Women and girl machine operators jumped from the 8th, 9th, and 10th floors in groups of 2s and 3s into life nets, and their bodies spun downward from the high windows of the building, so close together that the few nets soon were broken, and the firemen and passers-by who helped hold them were crushed to the pavement by the rain of falling bodies. Within a few minutes after the first cry of fire had been yelled on the eighth floor of the building, 53 were lying half-nude on the pavement. Bare legs, in some cases, were burned a dark brown, and waists and skirts in tatters showed that they had been torn in the panic within the building before the girls got to the windows to jump to death. The mangled bodies lay there with the spill of water, which firemen soon were pouring from water towers and hoses into the building, soaking them. There was no time to clear away the dead in the street. Inside the building, firemen believed there were still dozens upon dozens of girls and men, and they wasted no time upon those whom they knew to be dead.
Unnumbered women dead go crying through our singing.
Why did so many die in the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire? The doors were locked to prevent union organizers from getting in.
Sweatshop labor is not a thing of the past, either abroad or at home, and most workers in the garment trade are women. Elaine Bernard, executive director of the Harvard Trade Union Program, addressed sweatshop labor and issues of labor organizing generally at Rebuilding Bridges, a conference at Cornell University last November, which brought students, labor leaders, activists, and rank-and-file workers together to discuss labor and activism. Dr. Bernard's research focuses on the role of unions in promoting civil society, democracy, and economic growth.